So you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
When a competent observer looks for signs of despotism in a community, he looks beyond fine words and noble phrases.
It's society. They work for each other. They pay each other. They buy houses. They get married and make children. That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
Go into the automobile business and compete with the auto trust. Can I go into the grocery business and compete with the chain stores? Not a chance. Monopoly is the menace of free enterprise.
Because it's just a big money-making machine. They're wandering through a maze of inauthentic, fake landscapes, and they can't escape.
The message in all this is that the capitalist system in America is unfair and is, in fact, a failure at providing for basic human needs or maintaining continued national growth.
I can't wait for, like, the episode of, like, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where all the contestants, like, team up and they overpower the host and they share the money.
Bottom-up horizontal connection is sharing at all levels, not top-down control.
We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Because as communities go, so goes the nation.
Hello, hello. Welcome. This is the Three Left Show. This station isn't just music. Indeed it is, neighbors. Indeed it is. I am Dan Platt, local activist and know-it-all. Here with a talk show. You're going to hear me talk for 2 hours. It's called a talk show. I think that's what it is. And I'm going to say a lot because I'm solo and I might be doing that. I might be solo in the studio for foreseeable future, probably at least a month, as I try to find new co-hosts, and rack up guests, because I'm a good organized planner of a person, but, just doing this on my own. So I don't have that engineer in the studio with me. I don't have a publicist. Like some of those fancy schmancy New York City shows. This is community radio, bootleg, independent, guerrilla style, funny voice. Am I coming in clear? Hopefully there's no static on your end. We are turning it up here. So I'm just going to jump right into it. This is the light banner portion. Quick word on the week's news. Let's say the story that's on your minds is Kavanaugh on track to being confirmed as our new Supreme Court Justice. Oh, you're excited? Now, depending on how outraged you are, I need to ask, what the hell were you expecting? You think old fuddy-duddy senators, whatever letter they have next to their name, have your back? You think they have the best interests of survivors, women, whatever constituency you want. The only constituency that they serve is power. Obviously, they're in power, right? It's not that they have power. They are in office because they serve power. Now, who is the powerful? Well, I'm going to lay it out for you in the simplest terms. To say we live in a capitalist society, as I define it, is that we are ruled by those who hold the most capital. Capital itself is pretty neutral, you know, money, resources, but it's the people who hold the most, own the most private property that seem to rule this country. Not seem, they do. So if they want a Supreme Court justice that is on their team, that went to Yale, it's in all the great clubs, who will bust unions, who will rule in a conservative manner, then that is what will happen. It doesn't matter, as Trump even joked once, Kavanaugh could have killed someone, but excuses will be made. Not only because he's a white, male, hetero dude bro, but because he's rich. Because he has rich friends. Because he's in the club. And by club, I'm referring to the ruling class. This is a leftist show. I have a Marxian analysis. I see things in terms of class. Class intersects with many other things. Your blackness. Your sexuality. Or lack of thereof. And so on and so on. Gender as well. But class, as far as power is concerned, is one of the kind of baselines. So in terms of doing an autopsy of this disaster, what are the intersections? There's the sexual of power of men over women. Many are seeing it that way. And then there's the rich versus poor. And there's probably other intersections you can make as well. So there's that. So this first hour, I'm going to be talking anarchism, which I haven't done in a while. And then the second half will be electoralism. So if you hate talk about elections, now I almost feel like I do Green Party activism specifically because so many in our mainstream conversation will talk about elections. They make elections important. The basic, most minimum thing you can do is a vote once a year, maybe once every 4 years. It's just once a day, and then maybe a second day to actually like read up on the candidates involved, which so many don't even do. Maybe because it's assumed that they're all crooks. It's assumed that they all do not have your interests at heart. In most cases, that is a reality. Sometimes is not, and I will point out when that is not the case, particularly if there's a Green Party candidate involved, maybe even a Libertarian candidate. Sometimes they're just as right wing and dangerous to you. Sometimes they're more ambiguous. But enough about that. Anarchy, usually a frightening term, and I'm going to hopefully go through some stories that try to debunk that, as well as explore anarchism in practice. Now, I'm going to use the definition of anarchism from David Graeber, great author. His is just the living as if you're already free. Free of the state and free of corporate / capitalist power. This could mean making your own job so you don't have to be employed. It means squatting or some living arrangement where you are paying minimum taxes, minimum interference from localities. It could mean moving out to a county with minimum regulation, local zoning, et cetera, taxes as well. It means many things. It could mean living in the city and doing lots of community work, completely separated from the nonprofit sector, from any legalized sector, because there's the illegal, but there's also the non-legal, the thing where you're not doing anything specifically illegal, but you're not following the law, you know, filling out paperwork, going through quote unquote proper channels, as so many seem to do. Quick example that's really minor, but kind of goes into like how militant are we willing to be, even when we protest. There was a story. It was like basically one of the senators, and there's the survivor, sexual assault survivors, trying to, you know, to lobby, to pressure, to protest the Judiciary Committee. You know, the old white people deciding who's going to rule us on the court, and they were yelling at them, and they chased the senator into the bathroom. It was a male's bathroom, and they didn't follow him. I'm like, well, it's an unlocked door. You really gotta let an unlocked door stop you? You gotta let this expectation that it's a male bathroom. He's in a safe space now. The whole point is to make sure these people do not have a safe space, right? I'm always a fan of the direct action of actually going to the person in question's home and showing them that even there they cannot have peace and quiet, that they cannot pretend that they are not harming people, that they have to see it all the time, hear it all the time. Now, eventually, they'll probably get a lot of security and show you what money can really do, and that your protests are not factoring, however loud or good your arguments are, aren't actually being factored into their decision-making. It is what keeps them in office. And that's what the current voter bases are, because the voter base that could kick them out is not organized. So we'll talk about that in the second hour. So now I'm going to move on because we'll run out of time. Two, three anarchist stories. You can see stories like these at a site called Agency. It's called an they call themselves an anarchist PR blog, where they collect any story that mentions anarchists in a positive way. They aggregate those stories on their site. So this is from Big Think, which is kind of like one. It's like a pseudo TED Talk, where they basically collect people who are smart or research or kind of know stuff, and they give their takes on things as well as explain something. So it's a little pseudo educational. And this is a quick overview of the Spanish Civil War. Now, the Spanish Civil War, similar to the Syrian Civil War that's happening right now, basically the state fails. And then this is the thing about anarchism, is that it's usually looking for places where the status quo has pulled back or collapsed. And in that collapse, we find that very quickly, communities reassert themselves, social action and actual community organizing. Because what else are you going to do? There's an assumption that it's every man for themselves, and it becomes the whatever morality you see at The Walking Dead and other post-apocalyptic movies. But more likely, as is the case in real life, is when disaster strikes and infrastructure goes down, it is community that reconstructs itself. Now, maybe that community is doing some looting or, you know, scavenging. And maybe those are the places where community has been utterly destroyed, but where it exists even in a basic framework, basic mutual aid organizations are called, they step up and get the job done. And I'll cover that in the second story, in the second section, but right now we're going to cover the Spanish Civil War. So I just want to get that to say that in a state of civil war, the government has lost control over parts of the country, and it's there where new things can assert itself. Now, the basic, I'm just going to go through it here. Written by Scotty Hendricks earlier this year. When most people hear the word anarchy, they think of chaos. It brings to mind images of gangs fighting in the streets, looting and rioting, without a police force to help end the madness. It can be hard to grasp why anyone would ever declare themselves to be an anarchist, like myself. After all, most of the news about anarchists in the U.S. focuses on violent demonstrations, militant protests. But you might be surprised to learn what happened when anarchy reigned in Spain. During the Spanish Civil War, a brutal conflict between Franco's nationalists, these are fascists, and the Republican faction of the government, 8 million people in Catalonia engaged their own revolution. Based on anarcho-syndicalism, this is the kind of ideology that Noam Chomsky has, this is what he professes to believe, organized by trade unionists and briefly very successful, the revolutionaries offer us a possible image of what happens when anarchy reigns. Now, in this case, remember that anarchy is the lack of a state. Now, it can be the abolishment of all hierarchy and whatever, or all illegitimate hierarchy. But let's just say, keep it simple and say it's a lack of a state. So, in this case, you had governing structures, big unions. You had high unionization, production is controlled. And as soon as the state leaves and private property rights aren't being protected, the unions simply take charge. They manage a majority of the economy. They become, this council of unions becomes the government. So that's what is meant by this. So that was their revolution. They just kind of took over. The fundamental concepts of anarchism are statelessness and opposition to hierarchy. I just said that. To these ends, the Catalonian revolutionaries organized the region under cooperative and communal principles. Factories became worker co-ops, farms became communes, and workers even managed their barbershops. This was done without the utilization of state control. Society became increasingly democratic, and everyone was increasingly equal in both principle and practice. Now a quote from George Orwell, because Orwell was first and foremost a journalist, most known for his fictional novels, 1984 and Animal Farm, which he is specifically being anti-Stalinist and anti-Soviet Union. Here's one reason why. He fought with the anarchists in the Civil War. He went to cover it, and then he joined the fight, being a practicing socialist himself, from his book Homage to Catalonia. Quote, Practically every building of any size had been seized by the workers and was draped with red flags and with the red and black flag of anarchists. Every wall was scrawled with the hammer and sickle and with any initials of the Revolutionary Party. Almost every church had been gutted, its images burned. Churches, so yeah, maybe that will frighten you. Churches here and there have been systematically demolished by gangs of workmen. So this is because the Catholic Church in the area was part of the status quo establishment, you know, raping boys and all that. It's not like it didn't happen there. So maybe some that kind of justice was done. Nobody said Señor or Don or even Usted. Everyone called each other comrade and thou and said salute instead of Buenos Dios. Tipping had been forbidden by law since the time of Rieva. Almost my first experience was receiving a lecture from a hotel manager for trying to tip the lift boy. There was no unemployment, and the price for living was still extremely low. You saw very few conspicuously destitute people, and no beggars except the gypsies, the Roma. Above all, so there's a crack on there showing his problems. Above all, there is a belief in the revolution and the future, a feeling of having suddenly emerged into an era of equality and freedom. Human beings were trying to behave as human beings and not cogs in the capitalist machine. So what happened? It only lasted half a year. Well, they were undermined by Stalinist, pro-Stalin, pro-from the Soviet Union, communists, trying to draw support for their war effort. So there was a separate faction of Stalinists, and they undercut them quite a bit. This, combined with other factors, meant that the experiment had largely ended by the time that Franco had won the war. So was it all sunshine and rainbows? Not quite, as things are going to be messy and there will be problems. But hey, if you want problems, just look around right now in our own society. As homelessness is on the rise and poverty is half the country is poor, it has been pointed out by many sources that coercion was used to encourage this collectivization. So this is usually what's pointed out by liberals, that like coercion has to be used in order to socialize anything. Well, you know, it's if you're going to use a state or create, you know, different government, I mean, just say, I need to explain this, that our entire society right now is based on coercion. You know, when it comes to invading someone's space or private property or public property even, and you're not following any of the rules to the letter, the last recourse is always to call someone to beat you up, referring to the police. Resist the rest, you get beat up. So everything in our society is also based on coercion. You know, if you take something off the shelf, you'll be coerced into putting it back, and so on and so on. You know, and we have many starving people and sick children. Are there any examples since the 30s of how anarchism might work? Nothing on the same scale, though elements of anarchist thought, such as decentralized power and participatory democracy, are hallmarks of the Occupy movement. It's what radicalized me. Mentioned Noam Chomsky and so on. While most uses of the word anarchy invoke ideas of fear, madness, and disorder, the leading example of an anarchist society was quite the opposite. But questions of how anarchist society might endure in the long run remain, I think the same goes for capitalism. An example of how it works in the short run shows us that we might need to find a different synonym for chaos. Another quick example is right now in Rojava in Syria. I think they're doing better because there is actually Pentagon people on the ground, U.S., not boots, but advisors. They call in drone airstrikes and such. I don't know what the exact situation is. I last talked about this in the spring. And right now they're just trying to protect the territory they've gained. You know, they pretty much defeated ISIS almost single-handedly. Retook Raqqa with U.S. support. So right now they're getting some U.S. support, but that is a strategic alliance. And if it's not strategically needed anymore, like say we want to be friends with Turkey again, Turkey does not like what is happening in Rojava because it's a democratic confederation of cities and provinces that are majority Kurd, and which is an ethnic group, and they're basically doing a version of this. It's not like they had big unions that took power, but they're these citizen councils that basically declare themselves independent from the Syrian state and to form their own government, which is half women by their constitution, by the way. So there's nothing more feminist than revolution, I can tell you. Okay, so I'm talking about anarchism in general, and especially in the context of when the state fails, when corporate power, when corporations and, you know, cap and business fails, in general sense business, there's no money to be made, or there's no way of making money of any kind, then nothing happens. Usually nothing happens, unless it's charity. But charity is kind of up to the whims of whoever has the has money and access and the way of organizing it, also known as a nonprofit industrial complex. But anyway, when civilization fails, structure and so on, society usually does not, because the people are still there. And so here's an example. In Puerto Rico, anarchist organizers took power into their own hands after Hurricane Maria. From Newsweek, written by Arvid Devoir. So I'm just going to read it and not over-explain. I'll jump into explain something if I need to. In August, nearly 1 year after Hurricane Maria wrecked Puerto Rico's electrical grid and plunged its 3.5 million residents into darkness, island officials heralded a milestone. The lights were back on. The state-owned electric company even tweeted a photo of a smiling family it said was the last to receive power. But Christine Niles, an activist in Mariana, didn't celebrate. She and her small mountain community near the southeastern coast had already restored electricity on their own. Tired of waiting for the government's halting repairs, she worked with a band of self-described, they were anarchist organizers from the mainland to install a small solar grid, one of more than a dozen like-minded efforts across. They say self-described because whoever is writing this doesn't know anything about anarchism. So they're not sure. They have no basis to say, yeah, these were anarchists. Well, I do, and I'm going to say they were. By the time electric workers showed up, Milana had 2 months was 2 months ahead of them. The Puerto Rican Electric Power Authority declined to comment on this for this article. The power uprising over the second largest blackout in world history provides a window to the civic and political landscape in a place where government institutions, saddled with bankruptcy from U.S. debt to the U.S., and a federally appointed management board, failed in devastating ways. And by federal, I mean by Washington. It also underscores a sobering reality a year after Maria. Many Puerto Ricans are, to some extent, still on their own. For 8 months after the storm, Mariana residents lived without stable means of lighting, refrigeration, or laundry. People were on the verge, psychologically and physically, says Neves. She and her partner established Protecto Aeropo Mioto, or Project for Mutual Aid, to coordinate cleanup efforts, prepare meals, and check on locals after the storm. The initiative attracted the attention of a mainland group called Mutual Aid Disaster Relief. Those founding members did disaster relief work in New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina. To MADR, that's Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, co-founder Jimmy Dorson, Neves' efforts echoed his own group's anarchistic organizing, revolutionary with a more purpose than protest. MADR volunteers are already in Florida, helping in the aftermath of Hurricane Irma, when family and friends alerted them of the dire situation in Puerto Rico. They pooled their own money and solicited donations to purchase water purifiers, solar power equipment, and plane tickets to the island. It was quite surprising when they showed up to our operations, and they kept coming back, says Navies. Together, the two organizations distributed food and water and provides basic health care, setting up a key project, the installation of a solar-powered microgrid in Mariana, a self-sustaining electric system owned and managed by the community. And you're going to love how much this actually cost and think, why don't we set this up in our own neighborhoods? And the answer might not surprise you. But I also want to, in parallel, the news story that there was all this water, bottled water, okay, which of course becomes litter later, lots of plastic garbage, was sent to Puerto Rico. And it actually, a lot of it wasn't distributed to the people in the first place. I don't know exact reasons, but I'm sure corruption comes to mind, or the ability to scrimp dollars to pay back the massive debts that the government there has. Working with local construction workers, electricians, and even firefighters, volunteers overcame understaffed ports and destroyed roads to import a solar array, battery bank, and storage container to protect all the equipment from future storms. Total cost? $60,000. The grid now powers an abandoned school turned communal kitchen, a laundromat, and an office, where residents can charge their electronics and tools. The system does not reach individual homes, but its modular design can be expanded and transported to where need is greatest. 20 miles to the northwest, volunteers have installed a smaller system in Cargas, a city in the heart of the island. Despite police efforts to block them, locals seized a building and turned it into a center for disaster relief, a center for mutual aid. There are over a dozen mutual aid centers all throughout Puerto Rico, says Durson. And if the funding comes in, we will work with each other and every one of them to set up similar photovoltaic systems. Now, maybe I should define mutual aid for it all. Mutual aid refers to when it is not charity, but solidarity. That what true, what kind of, what goes into what real socialism is, it isn't a big, expansive, charity-minded welfare state. It is that when you give something to someone, when there is no expectation that they will give something back, specifically to you, especially, but even if they don't give something to society, because if you do give something and expect something back, that is a transaction. That is more of a, that is more in common with a market relationship than a basic human one. So mutual aid is you do things for other people for the sake of it. And it usually plays out that it will aid you in the long run because you are contributing to a society that collaborates instead of competes. And society that does take care of everyone, including yourself, instead of leaving people high and dry and judging how you allocate resources based on the someone's profit-making potential, which always gives me the heebie-jeebies. While there has been little proselytizing in Marina, radical ideas are in the air. What we have talked about is self-governance, Navi says, and we've talked about self-organizing. She uses the Spanish term autodigestion, or self-management, which anarchists have advocated since the time of Proudhon, a 19th century French philosopher who was the first to describe himself as an anarchist. Is the movement supported by authorities? Quote, that question assumes that local government and police are actually involved and active, says Navis with a laugh. Elsewhere on the island, law enforcement has in fact pushed back. Durson describes one incident in October, arriving in several vehicles, including an armored car, police conducted a nighttime raid on a church that Mutual Aid Network was using as its base of operations in Guanabo, a municipality west of San Juan. According to Durson, officers claimed they were acting on a call about kidnapping and questioned the volunteers at gunpoint, asking if they were building bombs, involved in Antifa, or advocated the overthrow of the U.S. government. After searching their belongings without consent, Durson says police evicted them from the church, threatening them with arrest if they returned. Calls to the Puerto Rico police press office went unanswered. While Durson acknowledges that authorities sometimes assisted matter by providing volunteers with food, water, and other supplies to distribute, he argues that government is nonetheless poorly suited for disaster relief. The state-owned electrical grid, for example, was allowed to fall into such disrepair that even after Maria passed, it suffered at least two more big outages following patchwork repairs. Quote, the government has access to a vast quantity of money and supplies, he says, but even if everybody in that institution had the best of intentions, due to their top-down nature, they do not have the fluidity or flexibility that more grassroots initiatives have. He cites reports of supplies rotting in government offices and accusations at both island agencies and federal authorities hoarded desperately needed construction materials. Unfortunately for both sides, another hurricane might be about to put his theory to the test. Well, many, many hurricanes have. Now, I think if you're a moderate or you maybe take a both sides approach, you know, there's a way of having both have their parts to play. I understand that. I think my purpose here is to tell the other side. This is a side of disaster relief organizing that is not often seen, not talked about, and not properly understood, especially by mainstream discourse, doesn't even factor in, because it can lead to other quote dangerous ideas. If we can organize ourselves in the disaster, provide relief, can we organize ourselves so that we do not need police and prisons and courts anymore? Can we organize property in a way that respects individual rights as well as common good and the need to share and take care of everyone in our society and not exclude people from groups? Because I think anyone listening to this perhaps has felt excluded sometime in their lives. What else can I talk about next? I think I'll hit quickly. Switch from anarchism to socialism here, talking about the way, you know, we talk about a word and a concept and all the different meanings it can have. Socialism in America, I will now just quote quickly, Gallup just did a poll, finally get to the bottom of a question of, you know, we're all talking about socialism now, thanks to some, maybe not all of us, of course, but it's more on the lips of mainstream. It's in corporate media. They'll mention it now in the context of a few candidates who express that they are democratic socialists. So that's being Googled more. But what does it mean to most Americans? Not most, but, well, I say most because a poll is never going to cover everyone. Especially when Gallup does it or anyone does it. You know, sometimes you can poll really badly and just call people with landlines. Who still has landlines? Well, it's an older audience, so your poll's going to be skewed. You need to find the different age groups and race and class. Class is usually left out. Usually, sometimes you just cover parties, but you just cover Democrat and Republican, leave out people who are registered third party or no party. I think that's especially, I mean, they say independents. And again, it's like, but they're not a voter block, okay? They don't vote as a block. They're not organized. It's like putting a label on something that is formless. And there's a lot of problems with that. So here are some highlights. 23% of the U.S. understand socialism as referring to some form of equality. That is very vague. 17 say socialism means government control of business and the economy. So kind of state socialism, state control economy. And that's close. 17%. Okay, I guess that I can work with that. So first of all, socialism is worker control or citizen. You can say, I'll say citizen, control of the means of production or the economy, let's say. Not only how business is done, but the allocation. So we usually think of the state being only able to do this. Now, when that is the case and it's done democratically, it's called democratic centralism, meaning power is centralized, but the application of that power is done in a democratic manner. This is the way Cuba and China do things. They have one party, but that party is, in fact, completely democratic as far as everyone in the party was elected from constituencies, various constituencies. And then they deliberate extensively over the policies of the economy, of the planning, the allocation, and try to and do all that cost-benefit analysis stuff. obviously many Americans still just see socialism as being a boogeyman, meaning that it's like a loss of, it's like government control of your lives. Let's see. Let's go through the list. We'll have a few minutes here. That's a modified communism, 6%. They're also comparing the results this year to the results from September of 1949. This is probably when socialism was at its height, as far as Socialist Party. I mean, I guess maybe a decade before. But it was, I don't know why they picked 49. I think it was the first time they did such a poll. And they asked the same questions, which bothers me. We have different issues these days. The economy works differently. It's organized, you know. Not completely different, but, you know. Does it involve a cooperative plan? Does socialism involve a cooperative plan? Was it, you know, 1% say that. So I guess I'm in that 1%. I'm a total minority here. Is socialism derogatory? Or do they give a derogatory opinion? 6% did versus 2% in 49. So does it just mean equality as a general principle? Today, 23% said that. At 49, it was 12, half. Does it mean government ownership? In 49, 35% said that. Now only half of that, at 17%, said that. Are they benefits and services, like social, free social services and single and healthcare? 10% say that that's what it is today. 2% back in 49. And what does it mean, a restriction of freedom? 3% say that today versus 1% in 49. The broad group of responses defining socialism as dealing with equality are quite varied, ranging from views that socialism means controls on incomes and wealth to a more general conception of equality of opportunity or equal status as citizens. So this is kind of a difference between those two different like lefts. There's the lefts that where it is a matter of outcome, that we all get a basic level of the same resources to live on and live well. And then you can get more by hard work and contributing more and or being more talented. Because there's a lot of those issues, you know. If someone's born talented or like physically stronger, they can do more physical work, that means they have more earning potential. These are those natural inequalities that make our unequal society apparently fair and natural. But we need to ask, is that just? Is that beneficial to everyone concerned? And that includes the environment and all life. So just a quick jab at that. So next, gonna go super local. This is a local Albany, New York story here, but still also featured on Agency, the anarchist PR site that aggregates any news stories that mention anarchists or anarchism. And sometimes, like in Team Vogue, there was a writer there did their own little research, or maybe they just featured someone with those leanings to write a kind of quick primer on anarchism for Teen Vogue. Teen Vogue, very radical-minded for some reason. I think that's just a signal that Gen Z is more interested in these things. Interested in alternatives, interested in ideology maybe in general. It's certainly a mixed bag. There's a lot of culture that's very nihilistic. You know, multiple older people have left them a crap sandwich. All right. And us millennials are trying to do our best here, clean some of it up, but we're also contributing as well in our own ways, trying to escape the system, while being inside of it at the same time. So here are some people who are trying to, in their own way, succeeded in escaping the rat race. Headline, Millennial Survivalists Share Downtown Squat and Anarchist Ideals. Now, I'm going to laugh a few times at this reporting. No offense to Linda Edwards, although in postscript, the group here wanted to correct some things and tell her how she kind of got things wrong. And Miss Edwards was not cordial about it. And even was like, "You're harassing me now. How dare you?" It was a downtown Albany townhome painted ivory, abandoned years ago, but with its elegant bones and tall glass windows intact. Gunn, age 30, my age as well, climbed the wooden stoop to turn the doorknob, and the door was unlocked. Like most abandoned buildings here in Albany, Gunn noted. The two-story walk-up had no electricity or running water, but inside was a wonderland of grace notes. Arched doorways, bookcase built-ins, hardwood floors. Now a huge black A surrounded by an O, the anarchy symbol. O is for order, actually. Adorned one wall, the symbol created in the 1890s, anarchists, then made famous in the 70s by punk rockers. And by the way, I'm going to laugh at this article because there's the misunderstandings of like the explaining of anarchists to like the readership of the Times Union, which is majority old and very uneducated on political science. Minus the experiences of dealing with local politics, taxes, and so on. Anarchist sounds as quaint and antique as Duel of Honor or Gargoyle Sculptor. Here's what it means to Gunn and his friends, who are also vehemently vegan. They are militant vegans. Shun all governments, champion the working class, barter and forage rather than use money. It's not putting it too strongly to say anarchy saved my life, said Gunn. Then it gets into his personal stuff, and I'm not going to do that. Given their distrust of government and off-the-grid life, the anarchists resemble wilderness survivalists prepped for the America's apocalypse. Well, in some of our neighborhoods, it's already here, all right? I mean, what is the apocalypse? Lack of investment, inability to acquire resources. That's a lot of America right now. But instead of hunting, fishing, or hiding in an isolated cabin, the anarchists live downtown and dumpster dive after dark and reap the unopened boxes of oatmeal, sealed bottles of juice, and pallets of sweet potatoes and purple plums. Quote, survivalists don't want to be around people. Anarchists are social. We love our neighbors, Gunn said. We're not nihilists. If the government collapses, we can survive living the way we do. But we'll also help other people as well. Talks about Garrett Mikulski, also age 30, a friend of myself, at least associate with him. A former electrician brings a battery-powered sound system to local parks so he can play vintage jazz music. He believes making music should be a free pleasure for everyone and gives guitar lessons. He bedazzled half the squat's parlor wall with color prints of buttsome nude ladies. 1940s, and again, it just goes into the aesthetics, and that's not what's important here. It should be noted that a group here, because I do interact with them on Facebook and whatnot, that they were disappointed that they wanted to make this story, they wanted this coverage to be mostly about the free market, and that'll come up later. But, and this is a criticism with love, and it's a lesson that they have now learned, is that when it comes to dealing with the press, and eventually that will be this station too, you need to control your message. That means you tell the reporter, or let's say you're on TV and you're being interviewed, exactly what you want them to report. Nothing more, nothing less. Now, you shouldn't be a slimy politician on TV or whatever and not just play down the middle, obfuscate, and whatever. I mean, you should say what you want to say, be clear, and give a definite answer to a question. But you should give the answer that you want to be reported, not something else, which is to show the reporter around your squat and assume they're not just going to write about what your squat looks like. And although they didn't say where the squat was, they also said that the address for it was listed on the Free Markets event page because you can drop stuff off there. This was a terrible mistake on their part because after this was published, the city evicted them, right? There are squatter rights, but they're very weak here in America. They're much stronger in Europe. Squatter rights meaning that you can move into an abandoned property because a lot of these vacant properties, even the city can't track down who owns them. If they're ownerless, then who owns them? Who do they belong to? I would say they belong to everyone then. At the very least, they're city property, like public parks. And if you can sleep in a public park, although there's they actually do are starting to enforce rules about that, the city has declared war on homeless people, and it's frightening to me. Let's see. It goes about, firefighters have never marked the house with a big red X sign that designates a building as structurally unsafe to enter. I think this is important. Later, right now, so the city put red X's on any building that the fire department deemed unsafe. These are the ones that actually are like missing a wall or something like that. This one doesn't, and there are many vacant homes that don't. But they're marked anyway. And a lot of people thought that meant they were marked for demolition, because that's usually like a big red X means it's, but it's more for the fire department to know that it's unsafe in there. But just because an abandoned house doesn't have a red X doesn't mean it's structurally sound, said the City of Albany Neighborhood Stabilization Coordinator, Sam Wells. I don't envy Sam Wells' job. He's the one-man guy who's basically in charge of wrapping his head and arms around the vacant building issue in Albany. There's 1,000 vacant buildings at least. And it's his work to actually count them and list them and actually get a tally of their various conditions. I would like to hope that the eventual thing that would happen from that is then the city actually repossesses the ones, especially when they can't find the owner, and then hand them out to people for a dollar. Right? And not just say, well, we need a responsible property owner, someone with capital, investment, and whatever. Meanwhile, there are people sleeping in their cars and on the streets who are basically being bullied and shoved around for who they are. And they're also, you know, mentally unsound as well. A lot of problems with the underclass. And these are problems that are not being solved by basically just forcing them to move from place to place, so they're not loitering anywhere or able to bother anyone. I mean, it's in the end of the day, it's not very humane. Even though, like, as far as the opinions of certain people in the city, they might as well just be killed. I mean, you don't hear it out of their mouths, but it's like, what do you want to do with them? You know, they're not able to work. And the welfare state has abandoned them for one reason or another. Sometimes because they were kicked off because limits were placed on how long you can get benefits or accept food or get food stamps. Because of all the rhetoric about people taking advantage and getting what they don't deserve. Makes me very angry. Moving on, Wells said abandoned house should never be unlocked because thieves can get in and steal the copper wiring and fixtures. He is right about that. And that is kind of a side story about how, because of how economically depressed everything is, we're pretty much stripping our civilization down. There are people who go around and strip the copper wiring out to get some dollars on the side. People who collect scrap metal as that's their income. The anarchists insist that they would not harm their home, although they can be overtly confident in their maintenance skills. You know what also protects a house from wire thieves? Having people live in them. Even if they can't afford or are not paying water bills. Because when it comes to the eviction of this squat, that's what it comes down to. They weren't paying the city water bills. They weren't paying for electricity. They were just using the house, and as others might say, it's unfair that they're not paying property taxes. It's like, well, it's unfair that anyone pays property taxes. Don't get mad at the people who are quote unquote getting a free ride. Why aren't you getting a free ride? I mean, why aren't you holding the city accountable for their misspending? There's a throwing up of hands and just impotent outrage that I see. But here's how they kind of get around some problems. So here's what goes into the practical concerns of squatting. I find this useful here. The anarchists, let's see. Oh, yeah, one former housemate tried to give the flat fee running water by removing the pipe's meter with a blowtorch. They now have what is dubbed the zero-gravity toilet. McCupsy fills a 5-gallon bucket, lugs it upstairs, and pours it down into the bowl to push excrement down into the sewer line. The zero-gravity toilet is a deal-breaker for a lot of women when it comes to moving in, McCupsy sighed. In a recent summer afternoon, he shared juicy watermelon and mangoes with anarchist buddies and University of Albany pre-med major Toby Warwick and their girlfriends. And this is something they had a problem with. They kept referring to the women in the squat and associated with as the girlfriends. It's like, well, they're not just girlfriends. They're part of this. They're part of the group. They are members. And then you don't even get their names. Let's see. It talks about their romance. Okay, now finally, the free market. And this is something that this group has been organizing all year, and I love it. A lot of people love it. So we'll talk about that in our last few minutes of the hour. It may seem odd for guys without conventional day jobs to champion the working class. What? Yeah, I think that opinion's totally bougie. Well, Clubsy's most recent foray into the world of work was his vegan stand-up comedy act. And I'm not going to talk about that. The free market is anarchist. She puts like a subtitle and then doesn't talk about the free market. Free market is the anarchist's true work. It inspired Warwick, 22, to join Guns Group. He has an apartment and a job at Albany Medical. The market was a transforming experience for me. I wanted to make a commitment to the group's idea. Yeah, so this is what they were really complaining about, that the free market is mentioned but not explained. And this is what they actually wanted covered, which was that at the Social Justice Center, the upcoming one is going to be October 28th at 33 Central Avenue. They basically accept donations of what other people would throw out or can't resell, or maybe you can sell it, but instead you simply give it in solidarity, mutual aid, and you basically have a free market, which is a really, really free market, which means that you have a bunch of stuff out, like a flea market or whatever, and it's all free. There's no prices. You just come and you take what you want. Leave some for others, but also just take what you think is necessary. For example, the anarchists had no idea what a pair of grab bars for the handicapped bathtubs were, but a man who uses a wheelchair was thrilled to get them. It reminded Warwick of how a prosaic item can be a life-altering for someone who can't earn enough money to buy it, no matter how hard they work. And this goes into them creating their own world. Millennials, and then you know she talks to the writer, talks about a professor about economics and how, you know, in these trying times, we're looking for alternatives. And since there are not equal opportunities and a lack of them, and maybe there are opportunities, but they're all for pretty bad, you know, jobs that don't pay the bills, or you need jobs that you need two of them. And we don't want to do that. We'd rather not. And there are those that think that's insulting because they worked hard and ran the rat race and got their pension. Well, no job has a pension anymore. No job pays a living wage. We're organizing to change that. But in the meantime, we got to survive. And a lot of people are coping, you know, or they're hoping or they're doping. And since some of the people here and me, you know, well, I don't, mental health struggles or what have you, we don't want to dope ourselves up, or can't. It would kill ourselves. And so they're making their own world, and that's what was meant by the Occupy slogan, another world is possible. To create a new reality through action and doing things differently. What would happen if enough angry taxpayers here in Albany or in your town decided to not pay, you know, they're so angry at, say, your local officials' policies that they decided to not pay property taxes until certain demands were met. Not a, we'll vote you out, because that's not the case right now, because it's still another 3 years until the current term's mayor, until their term is up. What do you do for those 3 years? You know, you lobby, you complain, you call, and that doesn't do it. They don't have to change because they're not actually threatened. But if you threaten by withholding paying property taxes, if you threaten to withhold your labor or your time or what have you, that's threatening. That's leverage. And that is the basis for a new kind and a different kind of power in the creation of a new world.